Hello, I am Sean Cleaver. Welcome to the Decolonizing Physiotherapy Education Podcast. This podcast is part of the Guided Reflection podcast stream of the 2020 INBITA Unconference. This activity includes three components. One, listen to a podcast. Two, record your key reflections and share these with other participants. And three, join a discussion with other unconference participants on the topic and the reflections that it has stimulated. This podcast is around 60 minutes long. The podcast is an exploratory work that addresses content that is typically invisible in physiotherapy curriculum. It is possible that some listeners with a particularly close relationship to colonization find the material difficult to process. Should this happen and you feel the need to stop listening, we encourage you to acknowledge those feelings, take note of the triggers, and engage in healthy, restorative self-care. The podcast includes multiple reflection points to make you think about issues related to colonization and space to reflect on your responses. We suggest that you listen to the podcast away from your desk. You might choose to listen whilst you go for a walk or run in your local area, or you could find somewhere to sit and listen quietly, away from other screens and distractions. At the end of the podcast, you will be prompted to capture your key reflections in a way that they can be shared with other participants. You can choose to do this however and wherever you wish. It could be as a video, in writing, a series of pictures, and could be saved as a note on your phone, a Google Doc, a blog, a series of tweets, or a video on YouTube. You may want to make brief notes on your thoughts as you go, i.e., you may wish to pause the podcast and your walk to note things down. But you don't have to record and share your response to every question. Instead, aim to capture the key reflection that you took away from the experience. Once you have created your brief reflection on the podcast, please share it by posting it or a link to it on the Decolonizing Padlet on the Unconference Canvas page on September 15th. After sharing your reflection, take a look at the reflections from other participants to gain different perspectives on the topic. These will form the stimulus for the synchronous discussion on the 15th of September at 2:30 p.m. UTC. To join the conversation, click on the link on the Decolonizing Canvas page at the relevant time. Happy listening. Section 1. Who are my people? What is our relationship to the place that we call home? Bonjour, c'est le début de septembre de l'année 2020 et je vous parle de Teotihuacan, là où les bateaux et les rivières se rencontrent, dans la langue du peuple Ginnungagap. Now I will switch to English. I know that what I just said is likely not understood by most of the people who listen to this podcast, even for those who understand the language that I used. First of all, many listeners outside of Canada are likely to struggle with my accent, given that it is non-dominant, by which I mean that it is very different from the accents of the larger French-speaking countries. Two, the name of the stewards of this land and the name that they gave to the land have been largely subjugated. If instead, I said that I was recording in Montréal, using the name given by the Québécois rather than the name given by the Ginnungagap, the number of people who know where I am located would rise sharply. And it would rise further still if I use the English pronunciation, Montreal. Although you might not have understood my opening words, there are certain aspects of these few lines that I intend to infuse throughout the remainder of this podcast. This is a podcast about people's resources and doing things differently. Please allow me to explain how I see these points exemplified through my opening lines, starting with doing things differently. I began this podcast in Quebecois, or what some might call Canadian French, fully knowing that English was the expected language. Did anyone tell me that I had to do this in English? Never. It was taken for granted. So I will ask you, before you hit play today, how much time did you spend thinking about what language this podcast might be in? If you thought that this content might be, could be, or even should be delivered in another language, I really want to hear from you because we need to talk. Nous devons vraiment parler de cela. Tenemos que hablar de ese sujeto importante. But for the rest of us, I want to draw our attention to how strange it is that we take it for granted the global dominance of one language, a language understood by a minority of humans, where there are a few thousand living languages around the world. As part of doing things differently, I invite you to pay attention to this way that we take language domination for granted. In doing things differently, I invite you to be open to perceiving things that you do not normally perceive. In addition to doing things differently, I claimed that this podcast would be about peoples. For this, we can talk about identity, especially collective identity, and how we relate to it as individuals. But beyond this, there's more. Beyond identity, when we refer to peoples, we are talking about ways of doing, ways of knowing, and collective senses of solidarity or community. Of course, language fits into this. I drew your attention to language because it is a lively and contentious topic here in Montreal, Tutuaghe, Montreal, but also because of its importance to my identity. Through this podcast, I will draw on my own first-person accounts of peoples and identities. I draw upon these first-person accounts because I can deliver these truthfully and faithfully. At the same time, I acknowledge and own some problems with this strategy. The first-person accounts center my story and the places that I know. Indeed, part of this, the problem that this podcast strives to address is exactly that, the centering of the perspectives and the interests of people who are positioned similarly to me. On this note, it seems like now is a good opportunity for me to remind listeners that this podcast is merely an introduction to the topic of decolonization. In order to explore a limited number of foundational topics to audiences that might be approaching these for the first time, some important aspects are glossed over or even excluded. For listeners noticing these deficiencies, I hope that we can collaborate moving forward. For others, I ask that you recognize that these first accounts are by definition limited, while simultaneously recognizing how these can effectively draw attention to more important issues. On to our third item on our list of three, resources. As I talk about resources, I will frequently draw attention to the especially important issue of land. Admittedly, there's a valid argument that we should not subsume land into the category of resources, lest it lead us to think about land as a commodity, that is to say, a resource that is rendered generic, to make it easier to buy and sell. Although this is a drawback to keep seriously, in later sections of the podcast, I will identify how resource acquisition, land, plus some other things, has driven colonization. So for our list of three areas of focus, we have doing things differently, peoples, and resources, particularly land. As I mentioned earlier, much of this podcast's content is drawn from my own first-person accounts. One way for us to move beyond these first-person accounts is for you to bring your stories and yourself into this reflection. Since you are listening to this podcast, the odds that you, like me, have some involvement with the education of physiotherapy students is quite high. Typically, in this professional context, when we talk about bringing ourselves, we're talking about bringing ourselves as professionals, as physiotherapy educators. For the purpose of this reflective exercise, I am going to propose that you do something different, that you instead focus upon who you are beyond your professional role. Since we are talking about peoples and land, I especially want you to home in on those aspects and ask yourself who your people are. The land that you call home, and I'll let you choose what this is. Maybe it's where you live and where you work. Maybe it's where you're from. What is your relationship to this land that you call home? Having asked myself these questions for years now, I can go first to provide you an example, just in case you need that. My name is Sean, and I live and work in a city called Montreal. The lands and waters here have long been stewarded by the Ganegaaga people, long before this place was forcibly controlled by people from Europe. People like my ancestors who came to this continent from France and England. Descendants of this European, of these Europeans, I am a settler on this land. In fact, I grew up elsewhere in the Canadian nation state. Yet it is easy for me to to resettle in this unceded Kanagahaga territory without ever having to ask the permission of that people. Now it is your turn. This section ends with the reflective questions. Where are your people? And what is the relationship to the land that you call home?
At this point, and at future points in the recording, there will be 1 minute of silence for you to engage in reflection. If you get to the end of this 1 minute and feel that you need more time, we invite you to pause the recording until you're ready to continue.
Section 2, Whose Stories Are Heard. Since I spoke about identity and place in Section 1, you learned that my current home is Montreal, with me arriving here from elsewhere in Canada, but that my family arrived in Canada from Europe. I also made a big deal about language and foreshadowed that this was an important part of my identity. Here, in Section 2, I will explain why. As many of you may know, Montreal is in Quebec, the part of Canada that is predominantly French. The place where I come from is predominantly English, and because of this, English is my first language, or as we say here, it is my mother tongue. I learned how to speak French as a young adult, eventually becoming sufficiently fluent to use this language professionally. Despite this accomplishment, I have a second language speaker accent and a name that draws unwanted attention. Cleaver is inherited from my father's English roots, and Sean is a misspelt Irish name that is decidedly not Quebecois. People often suspect that I'm not really from here, and they're mostly right. All this is very relevant to my current daily life, but the reason that it matters to my identity and relates to decolonization is a longer story. English is my mother tongue, but it's not my mother's mother tongue. She grew up speaking French in an exceptional situation. She was raised in a small French-Canadian enclave in an area of Western Canada that is otherwise very English-speaking. Her parents and grandparents moved there from Quebec. When she became an adult, my mom resettled once again, moving to the Toronto area where she met my father. When my mother left the place where she grew up, the family told her that she would lose her roots. I think it is for that reason that my mother cared so much for me to learn her family story. I learned of the hardscrabble poverty on my grandparents' farm in Alberta, where nothing was easy. My mom emphasized how people managed to carry on only because of a big, hardworking family and a tightly knit community. I learned of the way that the government interfered with this community, forcing my mother, her siblings, and her neighbors to speak English at school. Since, before Canada became a bilingual country in 1969, English language assimilation was the official education policy in most of the country. The cumulative effects of official policy and then moving to an English-dominant area have made it difficult for my mom to speak her mother tongue today. My mother's family story is one of pride overlaid with injustice. Meanwhile, my father did not raise me with the same sense of a family story. He was knowledgeable in history and has a good memory, but when asked about his identity, he is more inclined to describe himself as a regular or normal Canadian. In some ways, my combined family history is a micro version of a macro story of Canada. English and French found themselves together, the English dominated, but don't spend much time thinking about how things are. Meanwhile, the French know that they are being dominated, and therefore pay much closer attention to their identity and culture. You may or may not find this story interesting. Personally, I do, which is why I had to edit the story many times, cutting detail to the minimal amount that I thought would still make sense. but I propose to you that the most interesting part of the story is neither the parts that I told to you, nor the parts that I cut out. It is the parts that were de-emphasized or never told to me. Whereas it is true that my mum's family worked hard as rural farmers, the story that was told to me overlooks another important truth, that the land that they were farming was made available to them at lower no cost because it was taken from someone else. My ancestors benefited from this arrangement twice, first in Quebec and then in Alberta. In other words, a foundational aspect of my family's wealth is a result of stolen land. My mom ensured that I knew that the government tried and mostly succeeded to take her language away. Meanwhile, she never spoke about how that same government took away land from Indigenous people. And young me was never told that at the same time my mom was being forced into English, the Canadian government was deploying education in far more violent ways through a residential school system that not only imposed language assimilation, but ripped children away from their families and communities by force of law, on purpose. During that era, settler colonists Canada believed that they were helping Indigenous children to enter the modern world by severing their ties, not only to their language, but also their families, land, culture, and traditional knowledge. So what of my family stories? When aware of the larger history, are my family stories a problem? Well, no, and yes. My mother's story of loss and assimilation is a very important part of how I see myself. Although being raised in English to believe that I was French created an identity that confuses others, I feel that I've been able to respond constructively to this identity. Also, through my own journey of language and identity reclamation, I have earned tremendous respect for Indigenous peoples who are resuscitating their cultures, cultures that my ancestors tried to kill. When deployed in this manner, as an example from which we can draw principles and to use these to inspire solidarity with peoples who have suffered far more violence, then these stories might be a force for good. But a precursor of the solidarity is an awareness of the stories of other people, and it is in this way that our stories might be a problem. Despite its positives, one accurate assessment of my mother's family story is that its self-centeredness allowed an ignorance towards greater injustice. I propose that this assessment is even charitable. I think it is possible that one main purpose of my mother's family story is precisely to obscure the ways that our small comforts were made possible by state-sanctioned theft and genocide. Whatever your reactions to these stories are, the key message here is the need to actively look for those stories that are not being told, especially the ones that are being hidden for the purpose of erasing colonial violence. Reflection questions. That place that you call home, are there other people's home it is? Other people who have been displaced to make place for your people? Is there a story that has legitimized and explained away this displacement? What is that story? Section 3, Things That Are Skin Deep. Through Sections 1 and 2, the substantive content that I have brought to this podcast has focused on issues in Canada. I do this because Canada is the nation state which I know best. Moreover, Canada's story with respect to colonialism is an exemplary account of at least one phenomenon, that of settler colonialism, where Indigenous peoples are violently subjugated and eventually outnumbered by colonizing settlers. I think that it is important for us to learn about settler colonialism especially since the settler majorities in countries like Canada are just now, slowly, waking up to the violence that they inflict upon Indigenous peoples. Nonetheless, while Canada's stories are exemplary in some ways, the stories of other places could be more useful to help us understand different phenomena. To expand our consideration somewhat, I will talk about colonialism in a different place. Ma parler sur Haïti, yon côté m'degain temps pour moi connaît en pile. I will talk about a place that I have come to know well, the small country in the Caribbean that I call Haiti, with my North American and English pronunciation. In other parts of the world, the country's name is often pronounced something like Haiti. Haiti provides us a useful complement to the story of Canada. Like Canada today, Haiti was once a territory dominated by settlers of European origin. Unlike Canada, the European settler domination did not occur by outnumbering others. A disclaimer about my positionality in this historical account. I am not Haitian by birth nor background, but this is a country in which I have worked for an extended period. During that time, I devoted significant effort to learning about the country's history. Thus far, it seems that my understanding of the distant history of Haiti is reflective of a consensus. Nonetheless, I welcome scrutiny and correction from Haitian friends and colleagues. Now, back to the story of Haiti. Haiti is the place where the European invasion of the Americas began. It was off the northwest coast of Haiti that Columbus landed in 1492, thinking, at the time, that he was in India. While the arrival of Europeans in the Americas generally meant subjugation, dispossession, and death for indigenous peoples, this process was particularly swift for the Taino people who lived in what is now Haiti. Within a period of approximately 30 years, the Taino of this area had essentially succumbed to genocide. To the Spanish Empire, the destruction of this indigenous people was not so much an ethical or cultural problem, but a practical one. If there were no indigenous people, there were no indigenous slaves to work in Spanish mines. The innovation to this supposed problem was to purchase slaves in Africa and transport this so-conceived human commodity to the Americas. By 1700, control of the area now known as Haiti had transferred from the Spanish kingdom to the French, and the economic focus of Europeans in the Americas had evolved beyond minerals to products like sugar and cotton, goods that could be produced on labor-intensive plantations. The French colony in current Haiti was the example par excellence of this arrangement, and by the late 1700s, it is estimated that slaves of African descent outnumbered white settlers by a ratio of at least 10 to 1. This seems like a good time to pause this historical narrative about Haiti and turn our attention to certain principles. The first principle is to nuance the settler-indigenous binary that permeated through sections 1 and 2. The presentation of this binary can be useful in that it draws attention to the ways that European people migrated with at least some choice and agency according to the interests of European powers, to the detriment and dispossession of indigenous peoples. While drawing attention to the violence of European invasion is useful, the binary framing hides from view the violent capture and subjugation of African slaves, people who were reconceived to be property and transported against their will with horrific death tolls throughout the process. The second principle of interest is with respect to race. Many of us have been raised with the understanding that racial categories simply exist, and that these categories are processed to produce racism. This understanding is generally inaccurate on multiple accounts. First of all, it is patently false that racial categories are natural. Instead, these categories are socially constructed. As a quick example of the social construction of race, let us consider former U.S. President Barack Obama. Barack Obama is accurately identified as the first Black U.S. president according to the racial categories of that country. And yet, Barack Obama's mother is classified as white. So why is it that President Obama is seen to be a Black man with a white mother and not a white man with a Black father? Indeed, those familiar with racial categories of South Africa and Haiti know that if Barack Obama had grown up in one of these places, he would not have been seen as Black. The second falsehood related to the way that I was conditioned to understand race is what we might call a chicken and egg dilemma. In other words, which one came first? I was conditioned to understand that race preceded racism, yet this order of operations is not supported by the historical record. Instead, it seems that the need to categorize humans in order to justify the theft of land and the theft of bodies, it seems that this racist need to categorize stimulated the creation and eventual entrenchment of the racial categories themselves. On this point, I will add another pause to my pause to link this material to salient contemporary affairs. I imagine that all listeners of this podcast will be familiar with the term in the movement Black Lives Matter that has attracted renewed attention since George Floyd, a black man in the U.S., was murdered by police. Through the subsequent protests and increase in awareness, you might have heard the term BIPOC, meaning Black, Indigenous, Person of Color, a collective term to identify those people who are most harmed by racism, at very least here in North America. I invite you to note how this term relates to European colonialism, with its foundational conceptual supremacy of white Europeans and its violent dispossession and specific categorization of others. Now, it's time for reflection. What are the racial categorizations in the place that you call home? How do you understand the history of those classifications? And how do you understand the implication of that classification system? Section 4, It Is in Our Heads. At its outset, I pledged that this would be a podcast about doing things differently. Indeed, it is a commitment to this pledge that the first three sections were driven by narrative, almost without standard academic material, like definitions or references. In this section, I talk about the relationship of colonization to knowledge. In attempting to make space for alternatives to colonizing knowledge, I will simultaneously deploy some conventions of the so-called Western Academy. Don't worry, I recognize this contradiction. Ideally, I would be able to achieve commensurate goals while operating from a non-Western knowledge system. Unfortunately, I have not yet decolonized my mind to an extent that allows this. Now, some definitions. Since this is a podcast about decolonization, it makes sense to be clear about the meaning of colonization. Closely related to this idea is that of imperialism, which you will note is a word that resembles another word that I have used repeatedly, empire. The Encyclopedic Reference Book, Postcolonial Studies, defines these concepts by quoting the scholar Edward Said. According to Said, imperialism means the practice, the theory, and the attitudes of a dominating metropolitan center ruling a distant territory. Colonialism, which is almost always a consequence of imperialism, is the implanting of settlements on distant territory. A few notes to support these definitions. Said chose to define colonialism, which many consider to be an ideology or a policy, as compared to colonization, which is an action. In this introductory podcast, I did not pay close attention to the distinction between these terms. Also, since we have mentioned Said, this is an opportunity to draw attention to his seminal work and concept, Orientalism, an examination of the ways that Europeans discursively created the idea of the Orient. According to this discourse, the Orient is a vast exotic place in the East. Within the discourse, the exotic Orient just is. But when reviewed with an awareness of Orientalism, it becomes clear that the Orient, only exists in contrast to, and when seen from, the quote-unquote West, i.e. the centers of European empires like Britain and France. It is from this notion of a discursive East seen from the West that we get the term Western, as in Western knowledge systems. And it is these same Western knowledge systems that colonial powers used to justify their superiority, that is to say, the superiority of European peoples over all others, and the superiority of European knowledge over all other knowledge systems. In referring to Western knowledge systems, I am referring to those that have their origins in the intellectual turns in the Renaissance and Enlightenment historical periods that emphasized objective rationality and proposed the scientific method as the ultimate tool to establish truth. This way of thinking is generally associated to the philosophy of knowledge referred to as positivism. In this podcast, I am intentionally glossing over significant philosophical nuance. Indeed, positivism has faced tremendous critique from within the so-called Western Academy. If striving to decolonize, a more appropriate critique is offered through the work of Maori scholar Linda Tuiwai-Smith. Tuiwai-Smith's work is grounded in the reclamation of subjugated indigenous knowledge, while also accessible to those of us raised in the ether of Western knowledge. I do not claim that positivism is all bad, nor does Tuiwai-Smith. One problem that both she and I associate with Western knowledge is its totalitarianism, the sense that alternatives are inherently inferior, which has led to the subjugation, destruction, and loss of an infinitely valuable wealth of indigenous knowledge systems. Also, in this podcast, I will sidestep the chicken and egg question as to which came first, the Western knowledge systems or the European imperialist colonization project. For all intents and purposes, these movements began in earnest at around the same time in the 16th century and have been dominant global forces ever since. You may or may not have noticed this fact, but up to this point, I have hardly mentioned physiotherapy or physiotherapy education within the podcast. It is at this point that I will begin to relate the substantive content to our profession and our occupation. Here are some claims that connect these dots. One, the roots of the physiotherapy profession are in biomedicine, which draws most of its philosophical foundations from positivism, whether or not this is acknowledged. Two, in physiotherapy, our knowledge generation and dissemination systems are overwhelmingly grounded in Western traditions, even though we aspire to be a global profession of transcultural relevance. I propose that for those of us who are groomed and conditioned as physiotherapists and physiotherapy educators, the same knowledge systems that grow along with colonization really are embedded quite deeply within our heads. Now, for some reflection. Can you identify the ways in which your location, i.e. your people and your home, has influenced your thinking? Also, if your thinking, like mine, has deep roots in a colonizing understanding of the world, how would you go about identifying alternatives? Section 5, Structure Precedes Function. This podcast has been recorded in 2020, the year of the COVID-19 pandemic, during which many have rediscovered the ways that interconnected systems have direct influences upon the lives of, well, everyone. Moreover, The previously mentioned Black Lives Matter protests have increased awareness with respect to the nature of racism. While racism may be expressed through individual acts and is maintained through structures, most importantly, these racist structures present themselves as benign and disinterested, existing in a post-racial world of equal opportunity. When I think of these structures, the first that come to mind for me are housing policy, education systems, and the police. This list is not exhaustive. I kept it short because I have a time limit. Through this little intro, I hope to have your attention on structures and systems. So it goes with colonialism and imperialism. Yes, these phenomena have occurred through the theft of specific parcels of land and the enslavement of specific individuals. Simultaneously, as I hope you've seen through this podcast, these individual acts have been buttressed and justified through discourses and knowledge systems. Between embodied and conceptual worlds, there are multiple institutions that uphold colonial regimes, sometimes even after the stolen land has been given back to more rightful owners. In section 3, I shared some details about the Spanish and French occupations of Haiti, using this as a concrete historical example to demonstrate the social construction of racial categories. I brought this up to the late 1700s, but dropped the thread. Let's pick it up from there again. With slaves outnumbering French colonists by a ratio of at least 10 to 1, it should maybe not be a surprise that the slaves rose up, and to my knowledge became the only example of an enslaved people overthrowing their tormentors. If everything worked as it should have, upon independence in 1804, the self-freed slaves should have been able to control their destiny according to a radically different political and economic structure. As you can likely imagine by my foreshadowing, and possibly from Haiti constantly being identified as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, that is not what happened. I will pause the story of Haiti once again, this time to make a note about structures, ideas, and systems that are now taken for granted, but are in no way natural or inevitable. We'll start with the idea of the global economy. In 2020, it is relatively intuitive for us to talk about COVID-19 leading to a collapse of the global economy. Much conceptual baggage has been necessary for us to accept this idea. Beyond the mind-twisting heuristic that economies are things that can be measured as growing or shrinking by percentage points, a precursor to the statement making sense is an overwhelming global buy-in to one economic system, that of capitalism. We humans have long had systems to collectively manage resources. Nonetheless, the idea that this resource management system should be premised upon the private ownership of anything that is valuable, and that we should be able to quantify this value in currency to facilitate this exchange, well, that idea began in Europe. From the content of the podcast so far, you can probably guess how this idea was able to permeate around the world and crush thousands of alternative economic systems. Also, you may have noticed that I've used the term nation-state on multiple occasions in this podcast. I use this as a more precise term for what we casually refer to as countries. Like the current idea of a global economy, it is a relatively recent notion that we have a universal system whereby all land is properly assigned exclusively to sovereign nation states. While there have long been kingdoms and republics and municipalities, the idea of nation states is usually traced back to treaties that were signed in what is now Germany in 1648. So what does this mean for Haiti? Well, after the alliance of slaves and mulattoes defeated and expelled multiple European powers, the victors were not granted nation statehood. Instead, they were handed a bill from France to compensate for the loss of property. The most cruel irony of this is that the main property that France lost was 500,000 slaves. Although I have never spoken to a Haitian freedom fighter from 200 years ago, my guess is that many were willing to tell France where to shove their bill. Meanwhile, for a subset of Haitians, the isolation from the world's diplomatic and economic structures, such they were at the time, was a big problem. Accordingly, in exchange for international recognition, the Independent Republic of Haiti did accept the bill in the form of debt, even though it knew it could never repay. Through the newly formed systems of nation-states and the globalized capitalist economy, France was able to generate an answer for the following question. How is it that European powers could maintain control over colonized peoples and places even after their nominal independence? Many consider the debt crises faced by low and middle-income countries in the 1980s and the resultant imposition of structural adjustment plans in the 1990s to be the direct descendants of France's dependency experiment in Haiti. It might have taken me a lengthy example to make this point, but my point is this. Even after the colonists have packed up and gone home, there are structures that can keep colonial arrangements in place. Now for reflection. What are the structures that you know of in which colonizing dynamics are reproduced? Section 6. Are we sure that physiotherapy fits everywhere? A question derived from professional experience in Haiti. From 2008 until the end of 2010, I worked as the coordinator of rehabilitation services development at Hôpital Albert Schweitzer in the Artibonite Valley of rural central Haiti. Prior to starting this job, I had already lived in Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince for over a year. By this time, I spoke Haitian Creole and had visited multiple healthcare centers around the country. Nonetheless, I'd spent little time among the majority rural population. I was generally curious about the long-term trajectory of the patients who we would assess and return home from the clinic where I worked in Port-au-Prince. Did our interventions achieve their intended aims? Did these make sense in the actual context in which the patients lived? With this background, some book knowledge about community-based rehabilitation, and some strong opinions, I was excited to be granted the role of expanding a delicate shoestring of rehabilitation services into a coherent system. I was expecting some surprises during this exercise, but had no way to anticipate the ones that I would find. Through this period, my perspectives about foreigners, including myself, evolved significantly. I entered this role most proud of my expertise and ingenuity. This emphasis was consistent with my self-conception as a solution-focused guy operating at the grassroots. My average income was typically below my own country's poverty line, which left me a little confused as to why I was positioned as such a high roller when in Haiti. As I reached a level of integration in the rural economy, and learned about salaries and land tenure and the price of staple foods and the endless obligations towards one's people. My otherwise meager Canadian dollars seemed a treasure, far more immediately useful than the abstract value of supposed professional expertise that I thought that I had brought. Whereas I appreciated the contributions of other visiting professionals, I began to tire of the way that they convinced themselves that the duration of their annual vacation was precisely the commitment that we required. I started to gain an unusual form of respect for our local scam artists, who had learned sufficient English to convince the visitors that they would return to high school if they would just have someone to sponsor them, but instead cycled those dollars into the economy through the purchase of cigarettes and beer. I began to question the taken-for-grantedness of people like me being able to travel to Haiti on our own terms, to practice our professions, with basically no barriers, where it was at least difficult, if not unthinkable, for most professional Haitians to travel to and practice in our countries. Now, I will concede that the observations that I have presented thus far might be themed something like foreseeable problems and intended consequences of visiting naive individuals from a high-income country. I get that. With respect to this particular package of issues, I think that the recent and growing cadre of Haitian physiotherapists working in Haiti will achieve wonders. While the arrogance and bumbling entitlement of Western professionals might be most flagrant with their physical presence, I suspect that these same characteristics could be even more entrenched in more invasive ways. Whereas the physiotherapy practitioners are increasingly Haitian, the fundamentals of physiotherapy practice are decidedly Western, having been imported to the country through the majority of Haitian physios who trained abroad and returned home, or through people like me, who was first recruited to Haiti to teach clinical skills without a critical consideration as to whether my Canadian skills were fit for purpose. Given that it was my job to spend time in mountain villages and talk about disability and rehabilitation, I was able to gather a repertoire of observations about how physiotherapy might or might not fit there. One ominous sign was that rural Creole effectively has no word for exercise, and this does not bode well for one's primary treatment approach. Although people would seem to humor me by moving as I would suggest that they make movements, the idea of performing physical activity for an unforeseeable future benefit was not intuitive to rural villagers who spent all day doing physical activity to accomplish, well, everything. Furthermore, the idea of exercise as medicine was not consistent to their previous experiences with traditional medicine, a system that I never did come to understand, nor with their drugs and surgery experiences of Western medicine from the organization that employed me. I take the point that maybe we could convince the villagers to come to our side with respect to our approaches and the worldviews that support these. Where I disagree is that we should devote such energy to teach people to think like us, rather than taking the time to listen and learn more to think the way that they do. Having lived in Haiti for years, I can confirm that just like in Western countries, Haitians fracture bones and have strokes and have spinal cord injuries. Likewise, a percentage of Haitian babies are born with cerebral palsy, where amputations were frequent well before this became a subject of international interest with the 2010 earthquake. My reticence to import physiotherapy from Haiti does not come with a disinterest in finding solutions to the challenges that Haitian people face. Instead, it comes from a concern of subjugating the solutions that so-called uneducated Haitians already have. One possible example that I learned came from an elderly woman and her family from a mountain village. I met the woman because without a shared conception of physiotherapy ideas, I had asked local health workers to point me towards people who had difficulty doing things, like walking, talking, and eating. In the process, I was taken to a family that carried their grandmother multiple times per day, from the house to the sun in the morning, into the shade in the afternoon, then back into the house in the evening. Sometimes they carried her to church on Sundays. I would not have met this family had I asked to meet with people with disabilities. According to the family, she was not disabled. She was grandma. I propose that if physiotherapists listen to Haitian villagers, we might have more people to spread the word that functional loss in older age was a natural phenomenon that need not be resisted. Instead, its problems could be overcome with family and community solidarity. Such a lesson might have been valuable in Canada sometime before March and April 2020, as COVID-19 inflicted a horrific death toll on our senior citizens, or more specifically, those that we warehouse in institutions. Reflection time. Is it possible that striving to convince people of the value of physiotherapy is conceived with a mindset of domination that is akin to colonialism? Whatever your answer, do you have a sense of the values and beliefs that led you to answer the way that you did? Section 7. What would decolonizing physiotherapy education look like? In the 22 years that I have been a member of the physiotherapy community, I have rarely seen the words decolonizing and physiotherapy sit alongside each other. If we add a third word, education, as I was tasked to address in this In Bitan conference podcast, then the references are fewer still. With minimal precedence, this podcast was definitely an exploratory affair in which most of the content was directed towards helping people perceive the ubiquitous but invisible ways that colonialism is hidden in plain view. My suspicion is that once audiences clear the barrier of seeing the unseeable, drawing support for the subsequent steps of focusing on physiotherapy and physiotherapy education will be comparatively easy. Now that we are almost at the end of this podcast, I feel a bit more comfortable to be transparent and disclose how I felt about making this. Initially, I was elated that this subject was on the agenda and that I had been asked to speak on it. Very, very shortly thereafter, I was at least intimidated, maybe even frightened by the task. I had never been tasked with thinking specifically about decolonizing physiotherapy to this depth. Yet the timeline was short and competing obligations were intense. Although I had thought a great deal about decolonizing, most of this thinking had been directed at disability and global health, not physiotherapy education. Would I be able to do this subject justice? Moreover, it's not as if no one within the profession had been thinking about these things. As a white descendant of settler colonists, would my position allow me to see these issues effectively and prioritize appropriately? Amidst this angst, I frantically reached out for advice and any support from all the physiotherapists I know are, or at least might be, thinking about these issues too. Among these people who I contact, I thank all that replied with encouragement. I especially thank Lisa Arcobelli, also from McGill University where I work, and Moni Frick from the University of Manitoba for carefully reviewing my storyboard and suggesting improvements. To all those who were not able to get back to me in time during this frantic pandemic period, I do hope that we are able to collaborate towards this common good going forward. As you might detect from the tone of this section, I do not support the idea that I should have free rein to propose a decolonization agenda for our profession and its education programs. The folks who have the greatest expertise in this are especially our Indigenous colleagues, but also our Black colleagues, even if not Indigenous. Unlike the prime beneficiaries of settler colonialism and white supremacy, i.e. people like me, Black and Indigenous people are well positioned to see the problems and promote alternatives. In addition to identifying this podcast as being about peoples and resources, especially land, there is a reason that I also identified the need to do things differently. While not being sure of exactly how we should decolonizing, I do know that we need to pay attention to both method and substance. With colonization's triumphalism of the individual, discursively at least, and Indigenous ways of living in family and community, something tells me that innovations in decolonizing will be patently different than those proposed by Sarman, McKenzie, Bobath, or Mulligan. As opposed to individuals, my suspicion is that communities will lead the charge, and that these might be units like the Indigenous Committees of the Australian and Canadian Physiotherapy Associations, the Maori Partner Association in New Zealand, or the Black and Minority Ethnic Therapist groups in the US and the UK. I am confident that this list of communities is not exhaustive among those who have explicit wisdom on these issues. I apologize for any omissions. Although I will not offer prescriptions, I will point physiotherapist colleagues to larger discussions about decolonization happening outside of our profession. One of these discussions is about indigenizing, where a focus might be less on a direct undermining of the colonial project and more upon the infusion of indigenous ways of knowing and being. With respect to what is specifically referred to decolonizing, there is reason to believe that there is tremendous benefit in seeking to uncover the details of colonial violence and expunge these from our systems. Ultimately, as we are reminded by Eve Tuck and K. Wayne Yang, decolonization is not a metaphor for for expanding social justice or freeing one's mind. According to this perspective, the term decolonization must be reserved for its literal meaning, undoing the colonial project and giving the land back to its rightful owners. Our final reflection. What would you say that decolonizing physiotherapy education looks like? Where do you see the closest opportunities to contribute immediately to that goal? That brings us to the end of this guided reflection podcast on the topic of decolonization in physiotherapy education. I hope that you have found this contribution useful and that it has provided a few opportunities for you to consider your own position as a person and within physiotherapy education. I look forward to continuing this conversation, expanding the perspectives here to include multiple positions with respect to the dynamics of colonization and with respect to the education of our future colleagues.